Welcome to Insights and Indicators. I'm Jason Thomas, Carlyle's Head of Global Research and Investment Strategy. And in this podcast, I share observations and opinions on the economic landscape, as well as insights from research being conducted by our team here at Carlyle. Today, I have the pleasure of being joined by Marc-Antoine Bouyer, who leads our real estate business in Europe. We'll discuss how Carlyle's global real estate philosophy translates across markets, the current European landscape for real estate investing, and the opportunities Marco is seeing. This episode was recorded on October 13th, 2025, and the discussion reflects composite portfolio data and analysis of recent government reports that are accurate of that date. Before turning to Marco, a few notes about what we've observed in the portfolio. First, of course, we're now 13 days in to a government shutdown, federal government shutdown in the United States. So there really aren't those recent government reports. What we've had to rely on, as we always do, is portfolio data. Of course, we do have estimates through the end of September for where we see the economy based on the key performance indicators that come off of our 277 active portfolio companies. And I would say that first, U.S. economy in the third quarter looks to have expanded at an annualized rate of 2.7%. That's the point estimate that we derive from order books, from current business volumes. And again, relatively strong, of course. And this is shaping up for a year where I think GDP growth for the U.S. could very easily exceed 2%. We saw a rebound in consumption, household consumption, particularly experiences, travel, tourism, live events, that weakened quite considerably after Liberation Day. That probably hit a bottom in June of this year, according to our data. But it was also very much supported by overall business capital spending, which grew at a nearly 5% annualized rate. And much of that is explained, of course, by AI. And this is, as a category, is just these investments in what we could refer to as massive energy-hungry supercomputers. So it's spending on physical infrastructure, construction activity for data centers. Of course, the acquisition of hardware like GPUs, servers, other items, spending on related applications, and then, of course, related power and generation capacity. This is growing extraordinarily rapidly, and you do have a situation where a relatively small slice of GDP is accounting for between 30 and 40% of the growth we're observing. But I think what's interesting is that more and more people have focused on this and now, you know, suggesting that the economy in the U.S. has really become dependent on AI. I think our view is somewhat different, which is that there actually is no dependence here. From a statistical perspective, the growth in these categories of expenditures have become statistically independent. There's no sensitivity to interest rates. There's no covariation with some of the broader fluctuations we see in the economy. This is a part of the economy that very much observes its own laws of motion, you could say. And I think that this is something that could continue for some time. When you look at how this is being financed, it's primarily from internally generated cash flows of mega cap tech companies. Whether it's additional partnerships that have emerged in recent months, and I think that will continue. But right now, this capital spending is only consuming about 70% of cash from operations. And it looks like another 12 to 15 months before there's any requirement to rely on external finance. The issue, of course, is the power constraints and how much investment is required to power these facilities. And I think that that's a more likely constraint in terms of ultimately slowing the growth in this sector than anything else, the production of hardware or, again, just the access to sufficient capital. The final thing I would say is that despite a pretty rosy economic outlook, we did see or estimate that payroll employment growth slowed to a monthly average of about 15,000 or slightly less than 20,000 in the United States during the third quarter. You had payroll employment growth growing at 200,000 entering the year. So to see it slow by this magnitude, typically that would only be observed in a recession or economy that is on the cusp of recession. In this case, I think it's really two factors. First, the extent to which the corporate sector has had to internalize the cost of tariffs has led to some reluctance to add to payroll. So there has been some weakness in hiring to that. But I think the bigger impact is actually the dramatic change in immigration policy, the move from very large inflows to what looks to be perhaps close to net zero immigration in 2025, I think is just naturally slowing the supply of labor, available labor. And if you think about the United States, the domestic population, the expected growth rate this year, births minus deaths, is only about 14 basis points. If you were to apply that to a payroll employment of about 160 million, that would imply monthly payroll employment growth of only about 18,000 per month at full employment, which is, of course, not far from where we are. So I think the issue for the Fed right now, of course, seeing the slowdown in payroll employment naturally would incline them to think about additional rate cuts beyond what was enacted in September. But if this is actually primarily driven by a decline in supply, the decline in the growth rate of the labor force, additional rate cuts could actually prove counterproductive, leading to a wage price spiral sometime in 2026. So it does seem a time to tread very carefully. And again, it's interesting because I think that in some ways, the difficulty of identifying supply versus demand and what's driving the observed phenomenon is quite similar to 2021, where the Fed assumed that the supply constraints that were observed at that time during what was referred to as the supply chain crisis was really just related to supply disruptions from the pandemic that would resolve over time. I think we could say in retrospect, they probably got that wrong. And inflation expected to be transitory persisted for much longer and, of course, was much more intense than expected. So I think from that experience, I would also suggest a bit more caution here and thinking that this could be something that is not primarily weakening in demand for labor, but could be coming instead on the supply side. So with that, I want to bring Marco in. And Marco, thank you so much for joining us this month.
Thank you so much for having me. You know, I'm a keen reader of your research, and it's great to take part in maybe the research or the discussion for once. So thank you so much. Delighted to be here.
So I wanted to talk about, just at the outset, about your relationship to Carlyle in the U.S. and the U.S. real estate team led by Rob Stuckey. And how does that work in terms of, you know, your connectivity to the team?
Yeah, first of all, I mean, if you look at the principles, right, how we look at investing, we very much try to have this one Carlyle approach looking at investing into real estate. And some of the points you just mentioned, you know, around maybe volatility, room for policy mistakes, you know, like points to the kind of uncertainty and volatile environment that we're seeing, I would say, across the globe. We certainly have a fair share in Europe as well. And I think the overarching principle, if you want, of our approach to investing into real estate is to try to avoid that volatility, that cyclicality that we see sometimes from GDP growth, sometimes from external shocks, and really focus on sectors where we see, you know, stable demand pools, where we see maybe high cash flow margins, long tenant durations, all that aspects which point to our ability as real estate investors to deliver growing and stable cash flow, insulated as much as we can from, you know, GDP, economic cyclicality, or inflation, which are key risks, as you rightly pointed to. So we try to have that approach. And we, of course, as you know, we have a best-in-class U.S. business, right, in terms of real estate investing. I personally look up to Rob Stuckey immensely. Our team in Europe looks up to the success and the track record of our U.S. business. So we have essentially tried to implement those principles that have been defined by Rob and the team into a European context. And to do so, we have regular touch points personally with Rob, but also at deal level or deal team levels whenever we go into the sector or into some kind of investments. And the last point I would make maybe on that crucially is that in the US, you have a market which tends to be deeper, which tends to be more mature, which tends to be more penetrated institutionally generally. You know, for instance, if you look at institutional residential, the per capita ownership in Europe is only 7% of the US. So it's absolutely invaluable to look at the US markets, not so much as a way to copy paste, but really to see the deep trends, the insights, the best practices, what has worked in the US, because it's very valuable when it comes to looking at investing into Europe, because arguably the US market is 10 to 15 years ahead of where we are in residential, in logistics, in self-storage, which are key sectors that we share with the team.
So let's talk about the situation in Europe from a macro, but of course related to real estate investing. The shock of 2022 was not just rates, of course, as it was globally. It was also Russia's invasion of Ukraine, impact on energy prices, energy availability. Obviously, the German economy has been really treading water since that time, roughly flat. What are the changes that you've seen in terms of valuations, or how has the market responded to the economic shock?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you mentioned rates to start with. Obviously, higher interest rates have had a big impact in Europe because we started from a baseline of lower interest rates, as you know, than the US. Europe had been in 0% interest rate policy for way longer than the US. So the rate shock was very important. And then to your point, and we've seen that as well in, for instance, some logistics market stats in Germany, as you rightly pointed, some areas of the European economy, manufacturing in particular, has been very impacted by higher energy prices, higher inflation, some other sectors where, you know, like off real estate, where staff cost, for instance, is an important component of the cost basis have been impacted. So there's definitely been this combination of much higher rates pretty rapidly impacted a market that was very much used to very, very low base rates for almost a decade, right? And at the same time, inflationary pressure. And that means, to your question in terms of valuations, that Europe has adjusted negatively, like these interest rate headwinds in particular, has led to about a 25% decline in valuation since 2022.
And I guess, you know, there is also the big story in Europe this year has been the commitments to increase spending related to defense, to infrastructure. In February, there was in Germany, in response to both the security risks, but I think, of course, also just the economic stagnation, there was the constitutional change, the elimination of the debt brake, the 500 billion euros committed to, again, defense and infrastructure. And I think this has changed attitudes. I mean, you've seen that the capital markets shift in terms of their attitude towards Europe. There has been, at least the corporate side, or in both in public and private markets, new attitudes towards Europe. Also, the ECB, I think, waited to cut rates until inflation had more or less returned to target, which meant that, you know, they could continue to cut, unlike the Fed. It hasn't really been the same stop and go. It's getting rates back down to more normal or appropriate levels in Europe. I'm wondering how all this, the change in sentiment, and again, the more supportive financing conditions, how that is filtering into your markets.
I think it's a slow process, Jason. And it's very interesting, by the way, you mentioned, you know, the fiscal stimulus in Germany. That's one part of Europe. And the beauty of Europe and the challenge of Europe is the market reality varies on a country-by-country basis. So you see fiscal stimulus and expansion in Germany. If you look at France and the UK, you're more talking about fiscal adjustment and contraction. So the reality of that, you know, government support is obviously very much country dependent. But surely for Germany, we know that there are savings. We know that there is a lot of bandwidth to stimulate the economy because Germany starts from a low debt to GDP ratio compared to most other Western economies today. So you certainly can expect some positive impact from that extra spending. I will make a couple of comments. First of all, in Europe, everything takes time. So we have a large logistics portfolio. And in logistics, manufacturing in Europe is about 30% of demand, right? Like 30% manufacturing, 30% e-commerce, other industries. And we're not seeing yet a pickup in demand, particular pickup, I would say, in demand from manufacturers, because I think that stimulus has been announced. It has not been rolled out yet, and it will certainly take a bit of time. Generally, we try not to predict our investing activity on the resumption of a strong economic growth. We certainly hope it happens. It could support our activity, but really we try to focus on segments where we see resilience, where we see maybe less exposure to the economic cycle, as discussed.
Let's talk about those segments. You've already mentioned logistics. Residential, I think, is another area of interest where your portfolio is focused. And then self-storage. Could you just walk us through each?
Yeah, no, absolutely. So the common denominator, and in that sense, we also see it in the US, is that for each of these three sectors, we see growth fundamentals or demand fundamentals, if you want, which are not only predicated to the strengths of the economic cycle. So if you look at logistics, importantly, it's been strongly supported by the increase in e-commerce in Europe. And we see e-commerce rates today at about 16%, higher in the UK, where it's maybe similar to the US, much lower on some continental markets. Italy, for instance, is at 10%. So we do see some strong tailwinds. And we also hope, like you do, that there's going to be maybe a bit of a manufacturing pickup, a bit of defense spending pickup, even if we're not yet seeing that in the data. But we do see this strong demand baseline. And if you switch to, you know, a residential on the one hand, self-storage on the other hand, which are what we call our demographic-driven sectors, there the baseline really, I would say, is driven by urbanization, because we don't have a ton of demographic growth in Europe. Europe's population, it's very interesting to hear you talk about the impact of migration in the US at the beginning of the call. The baseline in Europe, if you look at actually demographic growth in big cities, you're north of 1%, because immigration has had a big impact in Europe as well. You look at a country like Spain, where investors in Madrid, in residential, in 2024, Spain recorded a more than 1% increase in population, purely thanks to migration. So we do have these very stable demand fundamentals around our big cities, and self-storage, which we like, is also driven by urban density, by the fact that, especially in Europe, we don't consume too much residential space because it's very expensive. We need more space at home. Obviously, home working has become more of a reality as well. So it's all driven by this urbanization and growth in big cities on the one hand. On the other hand, an important point that is worth mentioning, and a reason why we also like self-storage, is one specificity of Europe, as you know, Jason, is we regulate. So the residential market in Europe, in some countries, is very regulated. Think of, you know, Germany, for instance, or France, or the Netherlands. So being able to invest in self-storage alongside residential in less regulated markets is a way to play on demographic trends without being exposed to this regulated impact or regulated aspects of the jurisdictional framework, which is also a defining feature of investing in Europe, more so than in the US, at least.
Yeah, it's interesting the point that you make, primarily internal migration. You can look at an economy like Japan. Obviously, the population is declining outright, but that you have about 1% annualized population growth in Tokyo and other cities. So you can have actually markets that are undersupplied, where demand is growing far faster than the available stock, even as the economy as a whole is shedding population. And that's something that, as you mentioned, you see in many European economies as well. And so I think that those economy-wide population statistics are very often a very poor guide in residential markets.
Absolutely. And if I may add on that, Jason, because it's so interesting, right? You start from Europe, where also you tend to have predominantly, other than in Germany, a culture of ownership, right? Like around 80% ownership rates. Not a ton of stock in terms of institutional quality housing in the rental market. So you do have these very stable demand fundamentals, and you also have markets which are dramatically undersupplied in terms of existing stock. And you also have a situation where generally it's very hard, maybe much harder in my view, to add supply in Europe than in the US, because we have very rigid, very ineffective, I would say, planning systems generally. So you have the growth on the one hand that we discussed, on the other hand, dramatic lack of supply. Hard to see how that supply-demand gap can be plugged, because it's very hard to build in Europe and to add new supply, and that creates, especially for residential and safe storage, a fantastic baseline for us as investors, because by definition, resi, these demographic trends are very insulated from the economic cycle.
Yeah, that's interesting. The other thing that Rob Stuckey always mentions is functional obsolescence. It's not simply thinking in terms of depreciation rates or straight line depreciation, but when structures just no longer are suitable for current trends and demand in the market. And I'm wondering, given the bureaucratic issues that you mentioned in terms of construction, where do you think some of that functional obsolescence is most obvious?
I think to me, it's part of the very structural opportunity in Europe, is that our stock is not appropriate. Generally, I would say, we have a standing stock in Europe that in some cases dates back to the post-World War II environment. If you look at residential in Germany, 70% of the stock of German residential was built before 1970. Even logistics, which is a comparably maybe more modern asset class in terms of its development. More than 50% of the stock was built 15 years ago, and the same goes in the other sectors. So I think there's two points I'd like to make here. The one I already touched on, which is our existing infrastructure is actually quite dated, and there are huge investment needs required to actually bring it up to modern standards. And then within the sectors that we consider in the broader real estate world, there's also a question which applies going forward as to, okay, you know, how much CapEx do we need to spend into any given sector, considering, for instance, the pace of technological change or the expectations of our tenants. So it's another aspect of our investing activity. We pay a lot of attention to net cash flow margins, not only at the operational level, but also giving full effects to the CapEx cycle. There are areas of the market where the CapEx cycle has dramatically accelerated. You mentioned digital infrastructure, but even office, for instance, has seen a dramatic increase in CapEx. So you have to be, as investors, very mindful, I think, of that CapEx and I would say net cash flow margins aspect to investing. We obviously try to focus on segments and assets where those cash flow margins are higher than average.
Well, thank you so much for joining us this month, Marco.
Oh, it's been a real pleasure, Jason. I've loved it. Thank you.
No, it's fascinating to hear, again, the same themes that I know fairly well from the United States and the investment strategy being applied to a different market. And of course, the complexity of the European environment is always very interesting to discuss.
I think the opportunity is absolutely huge. We just need to build that consistency that Rob and his team have brilliantly achieved. And I think over time, we'll be as or more successful, because if you look at Europe, at the moment, pricing-wise, we are cheaper. The base rates are obviously very low. We're 10 to 15 years behind the US market. So that is incredibly exciting.
Well, thanks again. And thank you to all of you for listening to this month's Insights and Indicators. For more insights from across Carlyle, visit carlyle.com or follow us on LinkedIn.